Hello and welcome to the EMG Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia. And today I'm absolutely thrilled to have as my guest, my pal, Professor Mike Buick. Mike is currently working on a number of projects for businesses and organizations in healthcare and is the founding director of IQ4U Consultants. Great name, by the way. Professor Buick initially worked in hospital-based oncology before becoming a general practitioner and educator. With experience in both a hospital and community environments, he introduced community-based diagnostic ultrasound services and developed an academic interest in assessment, in fact becoming the Royal College of General Practice Chair of Assessment. During his stewardship, he saw through changes to the current membership exam for the Royal College. He's held leadership positions across the National Health Service, or NHS, as an experienced medical director, and became the Northern Regional Medical Director, and subsequently served as Deputy National Medical Director to my old colleague, Professor Sir Bruce Keogh. Mike's also advised ministers on healthcare issues, and I have a ton of questions, so he can advise us. Mike, welcome.
Good morning, and thank you very much for that lovely introduction, Jonathan. I never knew my CV was so helpful to you. Okay, that's a big build-up, you might say.
Well, yeah, and I know you won't disappoint, Mike. So let's kick off with something that I've got a little bit of exposure to. You and I have both been involved in supporting the National Health Service Entrepreneurs Scheme. You're also editor of the European Medical Innovation Journal. Tell us your thoughts on how we foster an environment that supports innovation and why it's important.
Well, you know, I think one of the big problems is that we have to have this conversation. I think that there's not an ingrained view in health and social care that innovation and research and development is actually part of our business. So we had to invent a national scheme to promote it. Yet we have other bodies within the UK, such as the Academic Health Science Networks, that are meant to be promoting this relationship between the innovators and the deliverers of healthcare. So I think to make it a better environment, you really do have to get to the granular part of our system, which says everybody in their day-to-day practice will see things that need changed, and you need to give them the space and opportunity to do so. And you also have to recognize that within organizations, there will be people who are absolutely, absolutely interested in innovation, but they're often not given the time or the scope to do so. Now, I think the National Entrepreneur Program, it became so successful because it actually allowed people time out to do it. And that's the biggest environmental change that we need in the workplace. We also need to empower people to do things with the prospect of failure being more likely than success. Because every time you fail at this, you learn something and you come back better. Now, we know that most innovators and most inventors have had numerous disappointments in that pathway. And we have to make sure that people are not put off simply because things don't happen right away.
Yeah, in fact, I recall Sir Ian Carruthers years ago wrote a document that basically proclaimed that fostering an environment of innovation, it actually improves health, not only because you're bringing new developments to the table, but you're starting new companies that generate wealth, and wealth very often equates with health. So does that make sense to you?
Well, Ian did the work on innovation, health and wealth, didn't he? You've just summarized what it meant. And IHW was one of those, I think, the prequel to what we've done with the Entrepreneurs Program. We've legitimized now the fact that clinicians can take time out to actually look at how they can improve their health services and probably make them more efficient. And I would agree that if you actually look in the long term, you will see health gain and productivity gain.
Well, let's keep going in that theme. I know you're fascinated by the interface of technology in healthcare. And in fact, you hold an honorary chair in digital health at the University of Central Lancashire Medical School. And I know that you've got an interest in managing chronic illness utilizing digital technologies. So how do you think technology is going to change healthcare delivery over, let's say, the next 10 or 20 years?
Well, 10 or 20 years is a long way away, and I hope we'll change it long before that. Yeah. I think my major focus here would be on the empowerment of patients. If you look at the amount of time patients actually spend with clinical staff, be it doctors, nurses, AHPs, or whatever, it's actually quite a small part of their life. There's a great paper called Wake Up to the Petunias, Smell the Petunias, I think it was called, years ago, which was written by the diabetes czar at the time, Sue Roberts, and looking at the sort of 365 days in the year when people manage their chronic conditions. And actually, our input was pretty minimal. It was guidance. If that guidance could be made accessible every day so that you could match what's happening to your health against a standard that you're expecting yourself to get to, you will improve outcomes. So we've done this for, I've done it in the field of allergy, where there's an application that looks at people with chronic rhinitis or seasonal rhinitis or asthma, and looking at their daily symptom scores to try and encourage them to use preventative medicines and improve their symptom score, but also to improve things like their productivity at work. So I think technology is the empowerment method for patients. At the moment, we tend to use it because it helps doctors make decisions, but actually I see it much more as helping patients in that decision-making process. In what will inevitably, and I think we haven't mentioned COVID yet, so we'll start now, is that patients are going to have to look to self-care as a major part of their care package. And we need to be in the business of training them to use appropriate technology to help them. And of course, it increases access because you can do that at any time of day or night.
Yeah, I mean, you've mentioned COVID and it's apparent, certainly in the UK, that the majority of care, chronic care, and new chronic care for new cancer patients has been usurped by COVID. So if we don't employ technology, we're going to have a veritable tsunami of bad outcomes to face. So, you know, I think you're going to be busy, Mike. So let's stay with the NHS. It's got a large database, and artificial intelligence, AI, and machine learning algorithms are being rolled out in various guises. What are the pluses and minuses of AI? What should we be happy about and worried about?
Well, I think the first thing is it's one of these things that's surrounded by mythology. It's as if AI coming in will suddenly transform healthcare. But actually, you need to train your workforce and train patients, as I was saying in my last answer, to look at how data is used more effectively and how we learn from that data to make things happen more differently. So on large data sets and using initially algorithms and then machine learning, you can start to home in on those patients who are most at risk and require a more intensive input from clinicians. Now, I think that's very helpful at a population level, but then we start to get down to on an individual level, when things aren't going so well, to give feedback to that person and ask them to do something differently. It'll extend into diagnostics more than anywhere, I think, in the next few years. So we already have information coming from King's in London around diagnostic helpful AI and diagnostics for radiology. And there's some brilliant stuff that you mentioned about the European Journal of Innovation before. That I have something to do with. And I read a paper last year looking at repeated CT scanning to get depth of tumour size, to be able to do tumour recognition without biopsy. Now, if we're going to start getting into the situation where machine learning can give you tissue diagnosis outside of the body, we're really into the Star Trek world here. And I think this has great opportunities for the businesses in this country in particular and in the Western world in general to actually start to look at how they can help in early diagnosis of what would have been irrecoverable disease. On the downside, there's a sense of depersonalization of care if all we're doing is using computers to track our patients. And I guess a lot of people at the moment, particularly after the distance that's been between them and their clinicians during COVID, are looking for something of a halfway house so that there's still that meaningful conversation with clinicians, be it over the phone, be it by video, or be it face-to-face. And lastly, there's always a worry around data and the use of data. But I think we have very, very good governance now, and sharing that data across systems is becoming easier, and that data is far more useful when we start to look at the wider determinants of health and improving looking after patients who are not as forthcoming early on in their symptomatology. So I think we can raise the bar here about how AI is going to help us, but also make sure that people feel protected and safe in doing so.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, you hear stories of patients having bad outcomes or non-ideal outcomes, should we say. I just read a story about a gentleman, I think he was in his late 30s, who presented to an emergency room with a seizure, a grand mal seizure, never ever having had one before. Boy, that's a mouthful. And he was put down for a, quote, routine MRI 6 weeks later, and I nearly fell over when I read that. You know, is that because the physician who saw him just didn't think things through or didn't get the history correct? Or, you know, if you had some kind of electronic system, some intelligent system that flagged it and said, hang on a second, a first epileptic seizure in adulthood should trigger an emergency imaging study because it's almost certainly going to be a space-occupying lesion that merits potentially urgent treatment. So I'm a big fan of it. And
in primary care, of course, where you do have actually a very advanced computer-based medical record, there are already systems in place that will give reminders, particularly for red flag type symptoms like you've just described. So, yes, right. There's a safety aspect of this that we've not yet fully capitalized on.
Yeah, so we need to embrace this technology and not run away from it and integrate it into our practice. And in fact, the word integration gets used a lot. What do we mean by that from your perspective?
Well, at its best, it's seamless care, so that a patient who is navigating their way through the difficulties of a health system, be it anywhere in the world, knows that whoever saw them last will have a record that can be reproduced to the person who sees them next, and that will be an accurate and up-to-date record, and that patient will be at the heart of that integrated service. At its worst, it's used as almost a fashionable statement to describe how a new policy decision has been enacted and the box has been ticked without actually the reality being given. And I think there's a great danger in the UK in particular, where we're moving towards integrated systems, of actually not describing what that means and the safety of patients within that system. And a lot more work needs to go on around the governance. I think it's one of these things that's easy to say, difficult to deliver.
Right. Well, until a few years ago, staying with the word integration, I'm having fun with this, Britain was integrated into the European Union. And then we decided to leave, Brexit. And I know that you've played a role in Britain's exit from the European Union. Is everything sorted? Regulatory pathways, tariffs on medical products, collaborations for research? I think we'd all like some good news, Mike.
I thought about taking the Fifth Amendment on this one. You
know. You're not an American. Nice try.
Look, I don't think it's going to be catastrophic as has been described. But if there's one thing we've learned in the past few months is that international cooperation is incredibly important. I had no beef with Europeanism. I'm a great fan of Europe. I just had a bit of a beef with the European Commission and the way it works, because it's so hierarchical and there is nothing much gets through that as innovative very quickly. And it's a massive bureaucracy. Now, I think that if the one thing that Brexit may achieve is some questioning of whether that's still relevant. And yes, it's sad the European Medicines Agency has gone to mainland Europe, but I don't think it's going to make as catastrophic a difference as people have said. In fact, I think there may be some advantages in that we now will be looking outward into other societies, particularly across the pond to America and also to Australasia, the Far East, to China. And a lot of the work we've been doing around vaccines and new treatments for COVID has demonstrated you can't just be partial in this. You have to be global.
Right. Well, I hope there will be good news and I hope it's not catastrophic. I share your perspective. So as someone who lived in the USA until recently, where the leading cause of bankruptcy pre-pandemic was excessive medical bills, and those struck with rare diseases often find that their insurance company doesn't cover the enormous cost. So let me give you an example. Gaucher's disease treatment, for instance, can cost around $400,000 per year in America. And again, some people discover, oops, my policy doesn't cover that. Whereas in the NHS, the treatment's covered 100%. I think in 2014, you were involved in an initiative, the NHS Rare Disease Response. Given that more treatments are being developed for these conditions and they're all expensive, can the NHS continue to cover such treatments?
It's a really interesting and I think relevant question as we get into the sort of super genetics, if you like, where we can describe down to point mutations exactly what's gone wrong and what we may be able to do about it. Yeah, I'm not an expert on genetics or epigenetics for that matter, but I do know from my work in rare diseases and very rare diseases, which where some of these costs really will be incurred, that there is a mismatch between the expectation once we've discovered the science and the ability of a society to afford it. Historically, that's always been true. Antibiotics were once incredibly expensive. Some still are, but when at their inception in the mid-40s, they were very expensive indeed, and people wondered how these would ever be used in a more global way. Now, I think that initially, of course, we can't afford all these. We have groups of people, either through NICE or through the NHS's purchasing scheme, or for that matter, any Western society that has this dilemma, where we have to ration and look at the evidence base. So we have schemes with pharma to demonstrate whether it's an effective treatment. If it is, then we'll buy it, but we want a discount. We want the first 100 patients free, et cetera, et cetera. And pharma goes along with this, but eventually, you know, they've got to turn a profit on their investment, and we're going to have to pay. But of course, philanthropy plays a big part here. I mean, I think that we have now people in the world who are richer than the countries that they often were born in. And that tells me that there's an immense amount of wealth out there that can be tapped in a philanthropic way. And I know Bill Gates does this, of course, with his malaria program, etc. So we need to have the sort of stop gaps, if you like, of introducing it, getting it paid for through other means, but eventually bringing the costs down by streamlining the process of the R&D, shortening the time it takes for those studies, and I think that's already happening, and making pharma a partner in this rather than seeing, as has been in the past, as a pariah. And eventually, I think we can get a more streamlined service to repeat the type of research you need to do without going through every single part of it. We see it for biosimilars, don't we? Biosimilars have come down in price, and you know, the biotechnology world is making it more efficient and cheaper to produce. But we've got a long way to go with it. I wouldn't like to underestimate the scale of the issue here.
Yeah, I mean, there's also an educational element, Mike, isn't there, that we've got to, people have to understand what it takes to bring a drug to market. I mean, I know COVID is, you know, people are using phrases like phase 1, 2, and 3 clinical trials and regulatory pathways, but, you know, having a true comprehension of what it takes to, you know, define a pathway, identify a target, develop a molecule, protect the intellectual property, do preclinical work, do phase 1, phase 2, and enormously expensive phase 3 clinical trials. And what is it, like 1 in 10 drugs makes back their investment? I don't know the exact data, but it's significant, right? It costs a lot of money to develop drugs, and people have to understand that. And if we want to keep advancing medicine, we've got to invest in it.
And there's a point in investing in it as well, because the spin-offs from those companies in terms of your country's wealth, we should be encouraging in the UK, I think, perhaps through enterprise zones and other sort of tax incentives to make sure that those companies come here to develop. I think what you're saying is right. I won't say which company it was, but I looked at, I was doing some work with one of the major companies a few years ago, and they had over 200 different oncological drugs in the pipeline. Can you imagine the enormity of that? The absolute enormity of the R&D that's gone into it and the cost. I mean, we're talking hundreds of billions of pounds here in the end, and you know, possibly trillions to develop this. But you look at what's happening to cancers now, and they're becoming chronic diseases. They are no longer the death threat they were.
Yeah. And that's because of pharmaceutical research. And it drives me crazy that we make the industry the pariahs. And I actually like challenging people who are the most vocal critics. Listen, it's not perfect and everything could be changed, but here's a telling question. If you believe that in your position, then you shouldn't hold any stock in that corporation. You shouldn't personally benefit from what you believe are inappropriate behavior. So, yeah, I think we need to educate a lot of people. And talking about education, what about future clinicians? What are we getting right and wrong in training the next generation of future clinicians? And in fact, making sure the current crop stay up to date properly.
You're very good at segues, Jonathan, I have to say.
I'm very impressed. Talking to you, Mike. We've known each other a good long time, so you make it easy, my friend.
Okay. I think that I've got a particular bee in my bonnet around training at the moment. Firstly, we need very, very specialised clinicians. I'm going to talk mainly about doctors, but we'll perhaps come on to other clinicians later. But doctors... when you go to medical school, what do you see in front of you? You see usually a guy in your speciality in green gowns with a mask on in a theatre. And I was watching a surgeons last night based at Addenbrookes, where my daughter works. And it's fantastic what you can do. But actually, most medicine and most difference is made outside of hospitals. And inside of hospitals, most people who come and see you are not coming for a single procedure. They're generally ill people with multiple diseases. And so you need great generalists, but we're not choosing at the entry point into medical school effectively people who see their role in a wider socio-health way as well as we could. Now, I think that's changing. And in fact, the Times yesterday ran a story about some of the new medical schools, and I'm associated with one of them, where that widening participation for people who were perhaps badly advised in their education that they wouldn't be able to do medicine, but have a bigger buy-in into their community to get those in. Now, people, when I've argued this, people say, oh, you don't like specialists. I do. I love specialists. I want them to look after me when I'm very sick. I want them specifically there for that. But for the majority of my care, particularly long-term conditions and primary prevention, I need generalists who can handle many things rather than a small part of medicine. So I think we've got to get that balance a bit better. I do think as we carry on doing that, we must realise that the limits of doctoring as well. And I think society needs to, through its politicians, both local and national, needs a little bit of a conversation with us about what modern doctoring is, because it's different to what when I joined 40 years ago, the profession. And I think we need to update what it is we're expected to be delivering, where and how. Because at the moment, as we've seen in COVID, people are getting criticised for not doing certain things, yet they're doing a lot of other things. And we just need to redress that balance a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, following on from that, as a segue, if you will, are we going to face workforce shortages? I mean, I know, having practiced in the States and interviewed folks coming into, well, first of all, applying to medical school and then applying for surgical residences and such like, that the numbers were declining. It wasn't the attractive profession that you and I went into. And Brexit may cause us to lose a lot of nurses and doctors, but what other factors do you think are playing a role here? Or am I mistaken?
Oh, you're not mistaken. It's an international problem. It's not a national problem. As you mentioned, the US is a big problem with this. And we're all fishing in the same pond for clinicians. And Mark Britnell, who works for KPMG now, used to be a senior manager in the NHS, has written extensively on that international workforce issue. And, you know, there's numbers bandied around that worldwide, we're 100,000 to a million doctors short of what we need. And to be honest, nobody accurately knows. It's just an enormous figure. Several billion people on the planet, just do the maths. You know, it's not, it's likely to be a big figure. But we're not just deficient in doctors. I mean, specialist nurses, paramedics, a whole host of things that we're declining. And, you know, how much do we want to spend on our healthcare? This comes back fundamentally to how you make it attractive, because you're right. I think a lot of doctors now people coming into the profession of doctoring don't see it in the same way that we perhaps saw it 35, 40 years ago, and don't see it as something they're going to do forever. And if you look at the number of people who leave in the first few years, it's only 2-3%, but that's a lot of doctors over a 20-year period that you're losing, and a lot of cost to society. So we've got to make it a little, coming back to a point I made earlier, what is it they were expecting you to do, and what are the opportunities if you're going to be working until you're 70, which is likely nowadays with the aging population? How are you going to develop your career to sustain it? Claire Gerada, when she was chair of the Royal College of GPs, talked about this sustainable 40-year GP, and I think you've got to think how it is that we encourage people to see that actually you can change what you do throughout that time. I've changed, as you said in the introduction, several times in my career, and I've always found that rejuvenating. And I think we need to make sure that we offer those opportunities to people in the future. And the younger doctors of today, they're deciding with their feet that they don't want to be full-time necessarily. Or if they are full-time, it's doing several different things to fill that week. So I think you're absolutely right that there's a major problem. How we address it is probably by altering that skill mix and actually getting people to work at the top of their license as normal, and then extending that license for other clinicians, so that what would have been once the domain of doctors now becomes much more the domain of other clinicians.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to a young lady who I've been mentoring, who's just headed off to med school after having an initial degree and then working in medical publishing as a medical writer, and certainly much smarter than I ever was. But I was just intrigued that the application process doesn't seem to focus on the sort of things when I went. I certainly didn't think I was anywhere near not only being the brightest bulb, but I don't think I'd have got put into any chandelier. But it was more about work ethic and compassion and interest in the human condition. And I just wonder if that's being lost. And that might lead to a changing role for doctors. So it takes me on to my next question. It's a segue, if you will, Mike. We know that nurses can do far more than they have traditionally, smart, committed, and very compassionate people. They can do things and are doing things like endoscopies and in primary care, looking after chronic diseases. So given the change in recruitment and given the recognition that nurses and other healthcare practitioners can take on a lot of the jobs that doctors were previously doing, what will the roles of doctors and nurses look like in the future, and how do we license people?
I think it's becoming a little bit of a dilemma, I think, for the medical profession, because we see around us nurses taking on extended roles. And some nurses, particularly in very specialised areas of care, like, say, neonatal nurses, some nurses in cardiac units, etc., who are doing, to be blunt with you, what I used to do as an SHO or registrar. And you know, we can't ignore this for any longer. We've got to look at some equity in this. And some, to be honest, respect. I think there is still, within the medical profession, a relative arrogance and hierarchy within the system. Now, I think that the development of multidisciplinary teams, either in primary care or in acute or specialist care, have actually moved that on, and a dial has changed. But there are still, at the training stage, that differentiation. And actually, there's a lot of times when we could do joint training. And I think some of the newer clinical courses look to doing that joint program training, because there's a lot of skills that we all need together. You were mentioning about doctors changing. And I think, you know, we don't test things like empathy. We don't look at compassion. We don't particularly look well at, you know, that sort of continuous care of people as much as we do more technical aspects of academic life. And I think that there's something we can learn from nursing, particularly around patient safety, which they're much, much better at looking at than doctors. My work on mortality tells me that all the time, that nurses don't cook corn as doctors do sometimes. And we, you know, we can learn a lot from them in their, I suppose, template approach to patient safety.
Yeah, Well, I think watch this space. I certainly saw this in my practice, that it's a question of training rather than title. And if someone can do the job, fantastic. In fact, in aviation, BEA and BOAC, when they merged, had a very different approach to managing the aircraft. BEA had a crew resource management approach, whereas BOAC had what we call man and boy, very sexist. So the captain did everything and the co-pilot just basically sat there in case he dropped dead. And it wasn't a great way to affect training, and it wasn't efficient use of the cockpit. So I think we've got to learn some of those lessons and not be so arrogant. So, but what about the role of social care and sort of, I guess, wider determinants of health?
Well, this is a really big question, isn't it? And in truth, we get pretty focused on the medical model here. And yet, if you look at the wider determinants of why people get sick younger, it's generally where they grow up, the housing that they live in, the epigenetic effects of the inheritance they have, as well as the genetic effects, and the behaviours that we still seem to tolerate in terms of accepting that some people will put themselves more in danger than others. Now, I recognise that there is a nanny state approach here that people just don't like, but you can be an educator, a facilitator. You can get children into good habits early on if you invest in that early years education. I'm slightly vested interest. My wife was one of the people who started up SureStart, and when that was taken out by the Cameron Coalition government, I thought that was a really backward step when actually it was about educating young mothers and families, and often usually mothers, about how it is that you can endear within your child something that's going to give them a legacy in their lives, that they'll live it better. Now, I accept that I'm a liberal at heart, and sometimes saying these things sounds a little bit more like a communitaire than a liberal. But there's horses for courses here, and we desperately need to look at those determinants. Otherwise, that obesity epidemic that we're seeing is just going to grow and grow and grow. And it is costing us internationally trillions of pounds that we could be investing in a different way to improve the life chances of our children. That's just one aspect of it. I think that we also look down on social care as health workers, as if it's something that we discard patients to, as opposed to embrace the skills that are there. And this has been seen absolutely graphically in the response to COVID, where we took for granted what was outside without giving them the resources and protection that they needed. And I'll leave it there because it's obviously a much bigger topic.
Yeah. Well, again, keeping on the theme of healthcare in our country, and it's funny, when I went to the United States, I was trembling with trepidation about how different it was all going to be. You know what? I think it was Churchill who said, "Two nations divided by a common language." There were actually very few differences between the delivery of healthcare. Yeah, differences in the way it's paid for, of course, but. Thinking about the NHS, last year, 2019, you published a document called Beyond the NHS. What were some of the key elements, the sort of the striking points?
Well, this was a collaboration with many others, and I have to say some incredibly gifted people who worked on this particular paper. And I don't know how much you've read of it, but it was a lot of data sets I was talking about before, looking at those determinants of health. But the thing that came to me was that the variations that we see, and Public Health England and others produce this sort of map of the UK showing the differences in outcomes that we all know about. But actually, localism is and the regionalization of health, to me, is what came out of that more than anything else. Yes, you can use population data to describe things, and we're brilliant at describing things. We're not very good at acting upon it. Now, I don't think a central model that we have at the moment run by NHSE and the DH is actually making that much of a difference when it comes to these health inequality areas. And I think if we had a much more regional structure, now I used to be really opposed to this. I mean, when when John Prescott went for his regional policy 20 odd years ago, I just thought we were developing another layer of bureaucracy. But actually, since the demise of regional health authorities and strategic health authorities, we've had less ability to implement health policies that are meaningful and change things. So I think that's really what I took away from it. And to do that, it's not just local democracy you need to develop. It's ability of people to determine locally for themselves what the best course of action is. So health and wellbeing boards, which you may not know too much about, which is, you know, the partnership between local government and health as to how you implement public health policy, need to be given much, much more power to do so. And in certain parts of the country, that's true, but we've not yet seen, I think, what we can do outside of the normal NHS-type structures and more into local government. Now, it's interesting, isn't it? Because today the Prime Minister is going to talk about the risk tiers for COVID. And it suddenly dawned on them, I think, that actually you can't do this centrally. You're going to need the regions, the cities, the large towns to actually have a degree of autonomy to be able to make their own decisions about how to keep their citizens safe. And I would say the same thing is needed when it comes to improving the health prospects of our citizens.
Well, I think it's also very important, again, going to education. I think it was one of the ministers from Scotland, because people are very confused about what they're supposed to do. And, you know, all messages in healthcare need to be much simpler. So for the COVID pandemic, it's very, very simple. You need to know where you live. And if you know where you live, look up what the regulations are where you live. What the regulations are, someone else, irrelevant. And things like, you know, colon cancer checks or whether you should have a flu jab or so on and so forth. We as physicians need to do a much better job distilling down. I know that, you know, in science, it's always a little bit of this, a little bit of that. It may be this, it may be that. What's the best evidence today? What's the best recommendation we can make today? And if we have to amend it in the future, we amend it in the future as we learn more. Make sense?
Yes.
Good. I'm glad you agree.
Who would envy being Prime Minister, Health Secretary, or the Chief Medical Officer at the moment? You know, I mean, I disagree with certain things they're doing, but that's our freedom to do so. But at the end of the day, you have to make policies and people have to live by them and give it a try, because we'll all have conflicting evidence. It's very easy to get an alternative view, but you have to take the consensus that you think will work. Now, if it doesn't, of course, you're an election here and you can choose to replace your government. But in at the end of the day, you have to have some trust in the legislator and parliament to support a government. I think that's a bit that's missing at the moment. We need that tie up between the legislature and the executive to be a bit tighter.
Yeah, I agree with you. But, you know, we also live in a world where there's a 24-hour news cycle, and yes, anyone with an internet with internet access and a microphone can be a commentator. Oops, look at that. Look what I just did there. It's exactly what you and I are doing. We have the democracy that we can access the airwaves and we can let our opinions be known. But that the key word there is democratization, is to allow for a free, fair, and hopefully kind dialogue. But, you know, you've opened a trap door, Mike, because you said, who would envy being ... So you've achieved a great deal in your life. You're a very, very wise man about so many areas of healthcare. I'm going to suggest that you wake up tomorrow morning and you're going to discover that you're the medical director, not just of England, but the world. So what three things would Professor Michael Buick do to improve human health?
Oh, this is the magic question, isn't it? I guess that there are some fundamentals that determine your health. The availability of clean water close to your home would be a start for many countries in the world to achieve even the most basic parity with the rest of us. The second is a sustainable food supply that is not dependent on others giving you gifts. And so that sort of links to the ecosystem that we live in, and to make sure that the environment we have, we either preserve or improve and don't continue to destroy. And the third, actually, I was toying with the idea of saying vaccines then, but actually I would go back to the democracy bit, making sure that the people who are implementing your health policies around you are accountable for them, and that you can vote them out if they don't do what is necessary in your country and they don't squander the resources you have, because all countries have those resources. So I'm going to put my third as the widening of a democratic process.
Well, they're all very, very sensible. And however many thousands of children die annually because they don't have clean drinking water is of course, a despicable anomaly. And I commend you for that. Sadly, we're going to have to wrap up. But given that Mike and I will doubtless be chatting again very soon, preferably over a glass of wine or two, I'm going to try and encourage him to come back on the podcast to talk further about his great work. Professor Michael Buick, Mike, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Jonathan. It was very enjoyable.
Well, if everyone listening has enjoyed this podcast, please share it with your friends and colleagues, like us on social media, and tune in again next Friday for the EMG Health Podcast. But for now, farewell and stay safe and well.